My name is Elizabeth Nixon. I'm a Canadian. I have American and British ancestry. I worked for Time Inc. in London for 7 years. At the end of it, I was European Bureau Chief of Life magazine, which was like being a modern duchess in London because everybody knew what Life magazine was, and it was so powerful to the English during the Second War that it was like every door kind of slammed open. So as a result, I met everybody and went everywhere to the extent that my nervous system could take it. And my territory was Europe and the Middle East and Africa, and that I was the only staff person outside of New York on Life magazine staff, although there were many Time bureaus, and I worked with those bureau chiefs. I left and went on to write a book about my family's experience with the MK Ultra program launched by the CIA in Montreal in the 50s and 60s, and my mother had been an experimental subject. We knew that because a couple of journalists in Toronto had managed to dredge out of whatever archives what had actually happened at the Ellen Memorial in Montreal, and wrote a couple of award-winning books about it, and the CIA was taken to court by some of the patients. And through discovery, it was really the first unfolding of what mind control was all about. So I wrote about that, and I went down to Washington, or I was in Bermuda then, and I went through the archives, and I wrote a book, and it was published by Bloomsbury in London, and Knopf, and Stidel, or somewhere in Europe. And then what I did was I came home because my mother is fragile, was fragile. So when my father died, I came home and I was stuck. I used to joke that if I came back to Canada, I'd be writing about trees and fish and joke. But that's what happened. I ended up writing about trees and fish and about the environmental movement because I was living in the country and I live in a green node where a lot of the leaders of the environmental movement have lived or still live. And so I started writing about that. That's basically, I'm sorry for taking so long. That's my story. I've written for The Independent, The Telegraph, The Guardian, The Sunday Times Magazine, The London Sunday Times Magazine, Harper's Magazine, British Vogue, etc.
I mean, nobody would surely give up a job being a duchess in London. This sounds like a great, and of course, these sorts of jobs are tremendous. They're great fun. It's a good test for people's creative talents, abilities, or whatever. And it's almost like a drug, being at the heart of, sort of current affairs and getting to know all these people. So suddenly, it was actually your mum, an MK Ultra, that made you decide to give this up.
Well, I mean, I grew up in Montreal in Westmount, so I lived grew up in society, to the and it was very much like English society, although at the time I was very young. But I understood the parameters and I understood the sort of essential fakery of it, and I got tired of it. I got sick of it. I just didn't want to do it anymore. I liked having, sort of polished those skills. Learned the ways of flattery to get into Buckingham Palace and Downing Street and wherever the hell else I wanted to go, but it wasn't deep enough for me. And I did a couple of amazing things at Life that they offered me any job in the organization I wanted, and what I wanted to do was get the hell out of it. So I left and I went to Bermuda and I wrote The Monkey Puzzle Tree.
Yeah, so can you just, I mean, look, so for someone that's worked in that sort of job for what is it, 86 till 93,
Yeah.
you've got to, you must have some tales from those days of journalism.
Well, I did get the rights to Nelson Mandela's autobiography, and everybody wanted it, of course. So a lot of the English publishers were very cross with me. And so the Americans weren't quite as aware of how powerful that was going to be. But I started writing Nelson because I discovered that he had been communicating with Winnie by putting letters in the wall exterior walls of Robben Island, and they would be smuggled to her and she would smuggle them back. And so I wanted to get those letters for the magazine. And one day I was actually giving a lunch and I came back in because my assistant pulled me out of the lunch and said, look, there's Nelson Mandela's lawyer is sitting in your office waiting to speak to you. And so I went in and it was Ismail Ayoub, who was about 7 feet tall. And he offered me the rights to Mandela's autobiography for £15 million. So I said, look, you're in the wrong office. Let me find you somebody else to talk to. But eventually, over 6 months or so, we did get the rights. And I flew to Johannesburg the couple of days before he was released and spent the first 3 weeks of his release in his back garden. And then the publisher from New York came in and we had a meeting, and that was fun. I mean, it didn't have anything to do with writing or reporting. I mean, I had four photographers there who I was nominally in charge of, but you probably know you don't ever get to be in charge of photographers, and they all knew a lot more than I did. But it was definitely a peak adventure, that one.
But you went to look at particularly at the environmental movement in Canada, and I suppose, you know, to a certain extent in the US too. I know you pretty quickly came to the conclusion that the environmental movement could have been extremely damaging for the environment, and so one starts to wonder, what's the agenda here? Who's paying these environmentalists? Where are they getting their priorities and tactics and decisions from?
Well, basically, the Rockefeller Foundation runs it. They have a meeting every year where they pull together all the funders great and small, and they all decide what they're going to do, what actions they're going to take the next year, and how they're going to fund it, and to what extent, and who looks good as a coming up local activist, and we're going to elevate him, and we're going to suppress her because she has the wrong eyes. It's completely controlled by the very, very rich.
Hang on, it's not just the very rich, is it? These are the Standard Oil monopolists, the oil industry.
From what I know of the oil industry, and they're terrified of the environmental movement. That is why they fund carbon capture and make all these abeyances to we try to get them involved in helping the desperate who are being persecuted by the environment. They won't go near it. I mean, they literally will not even fund a journalistic enterprise that questions the tenets of the environmental industry. I've met lots of people.
Right. Well, yeah, but hang on, Elizabeth. How did you first? What was the with your first antennae get tweaked by realizing that actually some of the environment was actually being ruined by these people?
Okay, so I came back here, and I was asked to write a piece for Harper's Magazine, which is a famous left-wing, leftist center intellectual, been around since the 1860s, extremely distinguished, about the island that I was on. And I was asked to write it in the using Shakespeare's The Tempest as my template, using the language and the plot and the characters of The Tempest. So I did that after some struggle, and it was funny, and it was kind of sweet, and I didn't really disagree with any of it. I talked to dozens and dozens of people here, and the blowback was so angry and so furious that I thought that they were going to burn my house down. And at that point, I started asking questions. At that point, I started saying, okay, there's something really not okay here. And the more I talked to, say, fishermen and loggers and ranchers and farmers, the more I understood the environmental movement to be directly destroying their lives. So I've sat in many houses all through. Most of my work has been in the States because Ecofascist was bought by HarperCollins and Adam Bellow. And I've sat in these houses where and listened to stories of what the business and the iron triangle of the environmental business, which is to say legislators, activists, and bureaucrats, how they have just ruined county after county after county, all through the States and Canada, and just sort of basically crashed them economically and shoved the land into protected areas. Most of these protective areas are under sort of quasi partnership arrangements, which if you really went into the documentation, the land would either end up with the government as collateral for debt or with one of the big organizations. One of my best friends in Canada is a funder of these people, and she has to. Her family are billionaires, and they have a food company, and they're operating in England too, and they save land here all over the place. Well, that land is nominally held in trust for the people, but nobody can enter it, nobody can use it, and at the end, it goes into her portfolio. She knows that it's not okay, but she's forced by the movement to save this land, forced. And so as a feint, she puts it into her own portfolio or her family's portfolio, given, you know, catastrophic financial collapse or whatever. So it's a scam. The environmental business.
So why are people not allowed in there?
Because there's a no touch rule in the environmental business. You know, you can't. I have a covenant. I have 16 acres. I have a ravine. I have a couple of creeks. I have a salmon enhancement pond. When I covenanted my ravine, I had to fight to get it to be no touch. That means not removing vegetation. That means no entry. That means no paths. That means no. Well, we don't really do anything more than walk in it, of course, but we move logs out of the way so we don't end up with a flood. But most of these lands are non-touch. Nobody tends them. If you go throughout ranching and logging company, what have lands, counties or former logging and ranching counties, those lands are clogged with invasive weeds. They pile up. They end up in like a fire tinder. That's the reason for the catastrophic fires all through the American West and in British Columbia and Alberta and I guess the rest of the world. Russia, same thing.
So you've just mentioned this Ecofascist book. This is a pretty strong title, isn't it? When did you get to the point where you were thinking actually there's a sort of authoritarian element to all of this?
Because there is. It wasn't actually my title. It was Adam Bellow's title. I don't know whether you know about him, but he is a very famous editor on the right. His father is Saul Bellow. He's published and edited some of the best writers of our time. And he also is, you know, he's a fervent anti-communist. So, you know, he was in many ways a shaper of the book. Of course, it was my ideas, my experience, my writing, and he hardly edited it at all. But it was his title. I wanted to sort of call it something about like the burning heartland, because it to me the real thing that was happening was that ordinary people were being destroyed across the American West, throughout the heartland, in every rural area in America. Ordinary people were being destroyed.
Can you just take us through like one story of what happened? You know, because I think it's, you know, you can talk about these in general terms, but sometimes it's important to focus in on just maybe one family and how they've been affected by the environmental movement.
Okay, so I'll just use the island that I live on, Salt Spring Island, as an example, because I think your listeners will be able to relate to it. We live about a 2-hour ferry ride from Vancouver, half hour from Victoria, 2 hours from Seattle. We're 4 times the size of Bermuda, which has 500,000 visitors a year and 70,000 residents. We have 10,000 residents, and we might get 20,000 tourists in the summer. 95% of our land is under preservation of some kind or another. There is a 5-acre minimum rule. You cannot have houses on acreages smaller than 5 acres. So that has meant over time that the price of property here has, my house is worth a ridiculous amount of money. It's a ridiculous amount of, it's merely because they have choked off growth and everybody wants to live here and nobody can afford it unless they're very, very rich. So we have 75-year-old women living in tents in the forest or in their cars, and little young women with children living in their cars, and it's disgusting. And no matter what we do, we cannot fight the regulation that's been put in place by the environmental movement. Now, I can go to Ferry County, which is a working class district in eastern Washington state. This is a massively forested area. Nobody in England can quite get the extent of the forest in the American Northwest. It is massive. It grows very, very fast. For many years, it was a going concern. So what happened when Clinton put in the spotted owl regulation, which was very, very bad science, all of those forested communities started shutting down. And they shut down in stages. So what would happen was that one family would go out of business, and then another family would go out of business, and then another family would go out of business. So that, you know,
okay, so what was putting them out of business? Why were they going broke?
The forests were shut down. No more logging. No more logging, no more sawmills, no more producing of lumber, no more producing of paper. The forests, they were industrial forests. They were intended using 200-year-old German silviculture. I mean, it was very highly scientific management. And all of the forests were left standing. You couldn't clear. You couldn't let your sheep and cattle graze. You couldn't.
But you weren't allowed to thin them at all.
You couldn't thin them. You couldn't go in and get firewood. You couldn't hunt. It was just so all of this bounty was put off limits. So as time went on, the communities began to shrink, and all of the businesses would go at it because one forestry job supports 7 other jobs. So that happened not just in the American West, but through the American Southwest and through the American South with ranching. And I mean, what you end up is, you know, Donald Trump. Those are the people that started supporting Donald Trump because they were being ruined. And Trump is the only person, the only politician that for some reason understands it and mirrors those concerns. And because those concerns are so fundamental, this will never go away. It will never go away. There's no suppressing this. There's no stopping it until it's addressed, until the resources are returned to the people who own it.
So what do you think is the ultimate object of this? Because it sounds to me as if it's going to be impossible for anyone to make a living in the countryside there.
Well, it's basically that's the case right now. Well, I mean, you know, I have connections who were in the Trump Department of Interior, and specifically, say, endangered species, which is the most powerful act outside of the cities in the U.S. and Canada, and they are able to actually use actual science and proven statistics. So how many bears? It's not this sort of panicked, we're killing everything hysteria that you get from the left, which is extraordinarily powerful, and it captures the imagination of every stupid woman on earth and every dumb kid, and just turns their minds into hysterical mush. And every time they shriek, another family dies. I mean, it really is as axiomatic as that. But in fact, during the Trump administration, a lot of that started to be reversed, and these people grabbed what growth they could. But since then, Biden has decreed that 30% of the United States is to be set off limit by 2030, and by 2050 it will be 50%, and by 2075 it'll be 75%. Everybody will be in the cities, the countryside will be off limits because everything has to regenerate. Species have to regenerate, and the air has to become decarbonized or carbonized. I don't know which it is. It's so stupid that I cannot even say the words.
Well, I think you've done pretty well there explaining. I mean, obviously, it's impossible to make a living in this. I mean, it does sound extraordinary to me, Elizabeth, that you've got, rather than these sort of small areas like we have in the UK at the moment, like maybe a national park, or which are quite big, or the areas of special scientific interest, that you've got massive, massive thousands and thousands of square miles of this, which has all got to be preserved.
Yeah. And as I say, it degrades. It explodes in fire. The rangelands get taken over by scrub weed, and they desiccate. The land needs to be used. Forests need to be tended. Alterations that could have been made in silviculture, but I don't even like saying that, because I don't think it's actually true. I think it's just propaganda from these idiots. You know, the forests were well managed. I have a family friend. He was head of Crown Zellerbach, which was one of the massive forestry operations out here. And just before he died, he said, you know, we pull logs and stumps out of the creek, and we would clean up deadfall and burn it and pull the stumps out so the land could regenerate. And they told us not to touch anything. So that means that all the creeks get clogged up with, you know, branches and twigs and dirt and rocks and trees, and all of these fields are left with dead wood standing, and they all explode in fire. It was so stupid. It was the stupidest.
But it's not necessarily stupid in a way. It's sort of devious also, because, you know, what you're describing is a form of depopulation. But also, of course, this land, if it can't be used, it falls in value. If the people are made bankrupt who were owning it, you've got these massive private equity firms now that are very happy to come and snap it up.
Yeah, exactly. And they're going to monetize it and sell back ecosystem rights like air, water, you know, growing. I mean, they are trying to financialize it. I was part of a group, a very small part of a group that managed to stop the SEC from making the rule that, you know, one of these hedge funds could monetize America's public parks. All the parks were going to be monetized, and people were going to be able to buy them and buy the ecosystem rights. So they're still trying. We stopped them one time. The thing is that these people never give up. It is demonic. They go right back to it as soon as they think the attention is off them and try it again. And I think it's one of the ways that they plan to solve this extraordinary public debt that they've run up, is by instead of assigning value to the future labor of Americans and Britons, they're going to assign value to their land and sell it back to them. So all of a sudden, public debt is going to be absorbed into land, and that is going to be charged to us because of our carbon, because of our outbreath. So we're going to pay for outbreath, and that is going to, they somehow think, is going to solve the debt crisis. If I could take these people out behind the woodshed like my prairie school teacher grandmother and whip them, I would.
Your eco-fascists book, one of the chapters is it's all about the water. Now, here in the UK, we've got a ridiculous and horrific situation with our privatised water companies, particularly Thames Water, where they apparently can't make money supplying water to London. They're running down their sewage treatment plants, so they're dumping raw sewage. They're also running down their water treatment plants, so they're sucking water, everything they can, straight out of the aquifers, which the old water boards never used to do. In fact, they're bringing the water table right down. And as it goes into basically like bankruptcy, this company, Thames Water, there are two choices. The one which is not being taken is the idea of renationalising it and taking it out of private hands. But what they're now deciding to do is to jack up all the water bills, the water prices, and refinance this.
That's exactly what they plan to do with everything. I think almost burdening these private enterprises with debt is the way that they get us to pay for everything. The left has always seen water as replacing oil, and for it to be the great trading currency of the future. And I suppose that is true, because nothing panics people faster than not having enough water. So, yeah.
No, if the water's not, I mean, the electricity may not go for a little while. You can put a candle on if it's nighttime. But if you've got no fresh water in a city and everyone's been herded, I use that word advisedly, into cities, then they really are going to do exactly what they're told. In a way, it sounds like a kind of people farming. You're talking about, you actually used the word demonic. You know, I didn't. But I think, you know, there is something quite evil about this. It, rather than it being some sort of financial instrument, what you're ending up with is people that have got actually no freedom, and they're controlled by other people who are basically parasiting off of them. So when you use this word demonic, what do you mean?
I guess what I mean is, you know, the devil is the father of lies. That's what I mean. Everything that comes out of the mouth of these people is a lie. I mean, every single statement is, you know, massaged and calculated, and nobody tells the truth anymore. So with the environmental business, I don't know if I've heard anything in the last 5 years that is actually true. It's all lies. So that's what I mean by demonic. Demonic is when there is no truth recognized anywhere generally by anyone. It's your truth or their truth. Or that prism, you have to see it through that prism. It's, you know, yeah. It's what we have allowed them to create out of our innocence and ignorance, I guess.
Now, I first came across you, something you wrote actually much more recently than Eco-Fascists, which, when was that out?
Eco-Fascists was published at the end of 2012.
The subtitle is How Radical Conservationists Are Destroying Our Natural Heritage. And by the way, I should say, Elizabeth Nixon is not like Richard Nixon, President Nixon. It's Nickson, if anyone's looking for the book. But the initial thing I came across by you was really looking at the prevalence of tattoos. Now, of course, this is something that many of us see nowadays. In fact, quite a lot of people who are at the extreme end of radical environmentalism. I've worked with people in the UK like Earth First. They were really into their tattoos for some reason, not quite sure why. And I would think of myself as someone that wouldn't even dream of doing that, because it's sort of, you're given this body. Well, why would you want to punch a load of holes in it and start scribbling on it? That's my thought. But why did you decide to write about tattoos, Elizabeth?
You know, it just kind of occurred to me that they were reverting to an earlier, more primitive form of human civilization where everybody was in tribes, and they would propitiate their gods by through human sacrifice and ritual. And warriors, Indian warriors, would tattoo their bodies before a battle in order to inure themselves to the pain of battle. It's the same reason why I swim in 50-degree ocean water. It's because if I've done that day, I can pretty much do anything. So to me, it's a reversion to that, and to the ecstasy that kids propitiate or seek out in the music that they listen to and the raves that they have. I mean, I don't know about England, but out here in the West, there's a lot of sort of celebration in the forests that are, you know, that go on for 2 or 3 days, and everybody gets very, very high, or, you know, mostly very, very high, and dances all night. And I mean, it's a throwback to a more primitive way of life, which I think they celebrate because modernism has served them so badly.
Yeah, so if you look at the writings of people like Dennis Wheatley, you'll see, you know, he was a sort of whistleblower, really, on the occult. And this is a normal thing that happens within circles of witchcraft and this kind of thing. That whereas you've got black magic, this kind of stuff, is that you have these massive sort of orgy parties, basically. Yeah. And, you know, another thing you say actually in the eco-fascist book is you talk about this idea of default to tyranny. So without this guiding hand of Christ, you know, this is where humanity might go. I wonder if you think you see signs of that happening.
Yeah, I think in the piece that you read, I said that Christianity was the first faith that said, no, you don't kill your brother's child to propitiate a god. I wrote a piece about the North American Indians and the South American Indians and land claims. And it was pointed out in this book that every single tribe would sacrifice members of their tribe every year. The Mayans, for instance, would kill 10% of their population every year in some kind of ritual sacrifice. The Hopi Indians were apparently the worst in North America, but the ones around us would have potlatches, and if danger threatened, they would spear a child or throw somebody into the fire in order to bring down the attention of the gods. That's how they thought of it. And I think we're returning to that. I mean, I see COVID as a huge elite sacrifice ritual of 10% of the population. I mean, I see it in everything now. Once you start looking at it, you can't not see it. And the thing about Christianity, I mean, I grew up in the Church of England. And of course, at the age of 17, I couldn't get far enough away from it. But the fact of the matter is that it is the most civilized faith that has come. It is the one that makes you love your brother, not hate, fear, and envy it. It's the second commandment. It is the critical commandment. That you don't you don't throw people into the fire to propitiate, you know, ISIS or Ra or Thor or any of those. So what we are doing now, in the absence of a sensible religious acceptance of our own duty to ourselves and to the future, I'm not even going to say God here, and to the future, is we're reverting. We are becoming slowly savages, and the kids and their nose rings and their tattoos are heralding it. As far as I mean, that ink is poisonous. Your body absorbs it. It's toxic.
You're in near Vancouver. There's actually quite a lot going on there with land, isn't there, and land rights and decisions being made around returning the land to the indigenous people, which, I mean, I look at and I think, well, fair enough. I mean, the Brits turned up. They said the land is actually God's, it's not yours, to the Native Americans. And then they started selling it off, you know, so it was a bit cheeky, wasn't it?
Where did you get that information, Tony?
People, isn't that what happened? I mean, when the British turned up in the Americas and the French, etc., they said, well, this land is God's. And so, you know, you can have a little bit of it, but basically we are the British royalty is God's representative on earth. And so they will manage it for God, basically. And there's now a backlash against that around where you are, you know, British Columbia area.
Well, okay. So, first of all, my family started coming here in 1630. They bought their land. The first people from my family that arrived here bought their farm, which is probably about 50 acres, from a Pocono sachem for 4 overcoats in 1637. And my first great-grandfather...
Okay, so from the Native Americans, you're saying?
Yeah, that we bought land. Individuals bought land. What government did in the 1800s and 1900s is something completely separate. And out here, we have a very pernicious Marxist left out here. They've been here for about 60 years, and they have entirely infiltrated the native populations, and they've kind of they've splintered them all into about 500 different tribes. They probably numbered at first contact about 15,000 people maximum. My family's history with Native peoples, we have 4 Indian tribes in our family. We have Assiniboine, we have Mohawk, we have Blackfoot, and Jamie's eldest son is part Métis, which is a French and Indian amalgam. So when in the 1800s, say, Indians used to be part of the culture. They used to be in and out of our houses. We used to do business with them. We used to sell them things and they would sell us things. They would come to our parties. They were with us. What the left did starting around, I would say, post-World War I, but especially after the Second War, was that they shoved them into an activist group that looked to take down the culture that we had built out here. And as a result, we have a very hard left premier who is going to lose the next election in October, because for the first time in British Columbia history, we have a new Conservative Party that is polling ahead of the socialists. And if we added in the sort of squishy right wingers, we would have like over 50% of the vote. This is going to be over very soon. We have to have sensible negotiations. Indians must own their own land. They don't even own their own land now. They're not, the government holds it in trust for them, and they keep it in trust because they can manipulate them. It's very angry producing. Now you've made me extremely cross. I'm going to go and have to go for a hike to clear my head.
Oh, sorry, Elizabeth, but okay. I mean, that's certainly what my reading of history. I mean, you know, I'm not saying I'm in any way some kind of oracle. I'm not, you know, but, you know, there was a kind of arrogant attitude of the colonists that, you know, we are God's representatives, all these people are. But I mean, you know, what you've just pointed out is this whole concept of what's called the Black Legend, this idea that, you know, that the white settlers were totally evil. In fact, if you go to places like India now, you find that the people are reminiscent of the English rule, because the justice system was actually much fairer than it is now. That you've got like you say, I think it's a wonderful expression. I've not come across it before, this default to tyranny. Unless you've got some kind of decent moral sense, this is where human beings go. They do become bestial. They do become very selfish.
That's what I said in that piece that you read, that when Christian missionaries went into native tribes, they converted people to Christianity because of the idea of the blood sacrifice having already been effected by Christ, and there were to be no more of them. So that's why Indians converted in droves across North America, and why those schools that have such terrible reputations and completely undeserved reputations now is that the Indians wanted to send their kids to school. They wanted them to learn engineering and math and how to operate in the modern world and not spend. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of famine in Indian tribes. There's a ritual that they used to do in Ontario where they would dance for 3 days and nights in a row, and in the final act of the ritual, they would eat their own flesh in order to propitiate the gods to send them deer. I mean, it was not a happy dancing bunch of peasants out in the forests, Indian life. It just wasn't. And that, again, is a myth that was propagated by the environmental movement. And here we are.
Well, I suppose so much time has passed that many of the records and memories of this have also passed with it. I mean, I know, for example, here we've got we've got the whole sort of Stonehenge festival hippie thing. Actually, again, you know, the archaeological investigations down here in Wiltshire discover that underneath every stone that was set there, and in many of these other stone circles, there's the skeleton of a sacrificed child. So this is romanticized, isn't it? It's being over romanticized.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And we're doing it again. We're killing people for sacrifice again. I mean, just putting aside the clear evidence of black magic and occult rituals among the elites, there's so much evidence of child sacrifice in Hollywood and in the sort of more glamorous industries over here in North America. People write me and tell me these stories almost every day, and I mean, I have to take a break from them. They are heartbreaking. They are heartbreaking.
So, okay, well, come on. You've got to leave us with a bit of light at the end of the tunnel, Elizabeth.
Well, I think, I think a lot of people are waking up. I think somebody said yesterday on Substack that we are at the end of a 200,000-year history that we are about to triumph over. We're about to say, no, that's over, that's done with. And ordinary people, and that's who I write for. I don't write for people who read the New York Times or the Atlantic. I write for normal people with normal educations and normal brains, and they're all very alive and very involved and engaged, and it's extremely exciting to see. I mean, the fact that in my benighted province that we actually have a plurality of people saying no to this vicious socialism that's destroyed the province. And I mean, my family settled Vancouver when there were only 4,000 people there. And the fact that the city that they founded and they built the sidewalks and they built the hospital and they built everything that has been taken over by Asian cartels, and we launder most of the drug money in North America through our casinos and our real estate, it's inconceivable. So people are finally saying, no, we're stopping this. So that's what I live on.
Maybe you could bring us up to date with other books you've written and how and where the people can follow you on social media, that sort of thing.
I write a Substack called Welcome to Absurdistan. And really, that's all I'm doing. I do have a wonderful publisher, but I'm just, the thing about books is that I don't like the publishing process. I don't like being trotted out on TV and radio shows. I don't like giving speeches. I like having a more or less private life. So this Substack thing it's financially rewarding. I get a lot of feedback every week. I meet wonderful people, like, for instance, you. And I'm completely happy just doing that.
So you haven't got any gossip about Harry and Meghan then?
No, I'm sorry. I don't travel in those circles anymore.
That's all right. Anyway, just give you just remind us of your Substack, finally, well, Elizabeth.
It's Welcome to Absurdistan.
So, Elizabeth Nixon, thanks very much for joining us.
A great pleasure. Thank you, Tony.